can't. It's very weird because you're like the weird Iranian communist, like weirdo friend on like the other side of the country. But you also live like you also live my dream life.
Oh gosh, well come and join.
Again, I don't know if you've heard about this thing, Corona beer or virus or whatever. It was the death of the American Empire.
It was.
How's Vermont? Is it getting winter? Is it winter today?
I'm looking outside the window and we have over a foot of snow and everything's covered in snow. It's freezing. But yeah, everything, it's beautiful over here.
That's the Green Mountain State.
That's right. The Green Mountains. Now the White Mountains.
Yeah. So we have lots to talk about today.
I know.
We got lots to talk about. Why don't I'm recording. I've been recording.
I know. I can see that. Yeah.
So why don't you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about why we're here to talk about your experience in Syria and as a guerrilla fighter. That's like this weird half Greek, half Iranian farm communist Che Guevara. mind you, I'd cry over like a hangnail, and like this guy over here goes and fights ISIS. I literally will cry over a skin knee or like a Charlie horse. it's the Nuremberg trials.
We'll get you on the farm, throw you, get you pitching hay bales.
Yeah. Oh, I'll like organize a peasant revolt before I work too hard too. Anyways, enough about me. You should talk about you.
All right. So I'm once again so honored. It's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Christopher Halali. And I guess these days everybody's interested in everybody's identity. So I can start out with I'm half Greek and half Iranian. My dad was born in Malayer in Hamadan province, ethnically mix of Lur and Kurd. And my mom was born in Montreal, Canada, from immigrant parents from Greece who fled after the Greek Civil War. Both sides of the family have, sort of a communist, socialist, progressive roots. And of course, most deeply in my mom's side, where my great-grandparents joined the Communist Party in the 1920s and 30s. That's the Communist Party of Greece, KKE. And of course, my grandfather and his two brothers actively took part in the resistance. His two brothers in the Greek People's Liberation Army, ELAS, and my grandfather in basically what would eventually become the communist youth, or at that time, EPON. So a lot of history in that was transformative for my politics growing up in that kind of a family with those dynamics. And of course, I think a very interesting mix. Dinner table fights consisted of who was better, Leonidas or Darius and Xerxes and all this stuff. So everybody was always fighting over who were better.
And breaking plates over people's heads.
Oh, yeah. And of course, breaking plates while dancing too. So... So go ahead.
This is your story is also like this kind of mixed story. You have this kind of mixed heritage that people sort of we fetishize this a bit too much. But the nature of your mixedness is also there's more in your Iranian identity, right? In terms of the story of kind of Iranian mixedness, right? Which is to say, Kurdish identity. Oh. Is part of Iranian identity, right?
Sure, of course.
It's been a part that's been negotiated. Like Iranian Kurds are Iranian and they're Kurds.
In fact, right? I'll tell you this because you hit the nail on the head. I am the first in the family to identify as an Iranian Kurd like that. Like my dad doesn't identify like that at all. My dad says we are
what
Iranian.
What does your dad say?
Yeah, we're Iranians. Yeah, interesting. We're Iranians. That's it. You know this, I'm interested in negotiating this because a lot of my sort of consciousness about being ethnically Kurdish or Lur comes from my participation both in Europe with, you know, Kurdish refugees and with the basically the organizations in Europe that support the PKK, and then later traveling to northern Iraq and then to Syria with the PKK and then the YPG. So part of me, you know, is kind of negotiating that and saying, I wonder, you know, of course, my dad, a result, a byproduct of the Shah's, you know, educational system, a totally different conception. He said that my grandparents, you know, Ma Bazurg and Ba Bazurg would, you know, speak in their native languages in the home, speak, you know, some phrases in Luri and in, you know, Sorani for, you know, my Ba Bazurg. But of course, you know, when I think about it, I think that my dad has this idea that Iran is a mosaic, but we should focus on Iranian identity first. Still has like that strong, like sort of, you know, Iran, one nation against the imperialism, this kind of stuff. Whereas I'm like, oh, let's negotiate all of our different, you know, ones from Luristan or Baluchistan or this and that. And my dad's like, yeah, but then they're going to fragment everything, you know? So I wonder, yeah. I sometimes look at that and I say, maybe, you know, this is a difficult thing because it's like, I want to like enjoy the rich mosaic that is Iran, but I know that outside actors are fomenting that, like they did in Eastern Europe and in other parts of the world, right, like they're doing now in China, to actively support separatism, to destroy strong states and create, you know, basically Balkans again with a Kosovo that needs perpetual support. It's on life support. So
right, no, and know, that's yeah, that's really good. That's a really powerful way of phrasing it too. And there's also this one thing that we, in our own education and perspectives, having grown up in like settler colonial societies that were sort of settled by white people, creating a kind of racial hierarchy, we have a tendency to collapse race and nation, right? Like, but the idea of nationalism, the very idea of nationalism, like as it grew as a concept, I mean, there's different iterations of it, and mm-hmm. you could talk about different things, but like the notion that Italy, that there is this thing called Italianness, that is strung together from people in Rome, people in Napoli, people in Florence, people in Venice, people in Sicily, God forbid, you know, like that is like a kind of imagined community, to use the famous now sort of hackneyed phrase that coined by Benedict Anderson.
That's right.
But like, it's hard for us, but that's us speaking in the West, speaking in the hellscape of like the offspring of a white settler colonialist society, right? But that's different in Iran. Right. Mm-hmm. That's why Absolutely. Your dad, it's not complicated for Iranians. It's like, oh, we're Iranian. There's this national entity called Iran. And within that national entity, there is this kind of mosaic of cultures. Now, mosaic of cultures is a kind of corny phrase now because of 70s Poco and like 80s Poco good feelings. Right. But mm-hmm. over there, it's real. It's not just marketing.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that like you're right, that nationalism in its development, you know, sort of in its iterations coming from sort of a Central European strong state apparatus. And then, of course, you look at projects like Mustafa Kemal Ataturk or, you know, Reza Shah and all of these different, you know, national experience, even Sun Yat-sen in Sun Zhongshan in China. And you look at, for them, this was really, you know, that's why I think that nationalism is a complex phenomenon, because people are, you know, I went through an anarchist phase. So everybody's always like, well, nationalism is evil.
Oh, I did too.
And,
I did too. Know, oh, God. So bad.
This, no gods, no masters, this kind of stuff. Destroy the state.
And I'm thinking to myself,
you know, I see this is actually, you know, this is interesting because this will highlight some. I grew up in as ML. So I, you know, in high school, I had a banner of the Soviet Union in my room, a Lenin, Mao. Actually, my parents were very nervous because here we are living in the US. They're like, you know, average teenagers in the US, honey, have, you know, pictures of rock stars and the Ferraris and this and that. And we walk into your room, it's like the Central Committee. So they were a little bit nervous, especially, you know, post 9/11, all this stuff going on. And then it wasn't until I went into like a grad school, started really studying and reading. And of course, I got pilled by postmodernism, post-structuralism. You know, you start reading all this stuff. Next thing you know, you're like, well, I'm an anarchist, or I'm a libertarian communist, or I'm an autonomous Marxist and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. After a while, it wasn't until I went to Syria where I realized, holy shit, I've been pilled. This is totally, yeah. We've all been co-opted for empire, you know?
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. And, yeah. Well, this is, well, we should probably get into it because we're dancing around the subject. Can you need to reiterate these last decade of your life? And it's, well, not really, because it's more complicated than that, because Syria was a kind of end result of a long period of radicalization for you, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So maybe begin with, you know, let's start with college, whatever. That's an easy place to start.
Sure, of course. So this background is I think interesting. I have an interesting arc. So college, I go in 2007, University of San Diego, in California, and I go into university and I got to pay for school. You know, that everybody's got to pay for college. I get some funding and scholarship, but I got to pay more. So eventually I make the decision, which was an extremely tough one given circumstances, but I make the decision to join the US military, join ROTC. So I do that. I join.
How did that put from ML to US military? What pipeline is that?
that's a very strange one. I'll tell you that much. It's very, very strange. Actually, it was.
But you grew up in San Diego?
No, I grew up in Massachusetts. I went to school in San Diego.
Right.
So I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, I know Worcester.
What?
Yeah.
So you were forged in the belly of America's most racist city.
Oh gosh, I'm telling you, it's you want to talk about ethnic enclaves? I'll tell you about ethnic enclaves.
Celtic Triangle.
I'm telling you, I always joke. I say I grew up in a neighborhood of Greeks, Albanians, various Yugoslavs and Hasidic Jews. That was our little
all the unwanted white people of America.
So I grew up basically, you know, my parents were like, you know, you're going to hang out with the ethnic community that we have and you're not going to really hang out with anybody else. So I hung out with Greeks and Iranians growing up. And then, of course, the neighborhood kids and then, of course, we moved from Worcester to a little bit more outside of Worcester to a rural area, which was, you know, real culture shock because it was kind of farming and it was very white and we were diversity there. So it was pretty wild. But
what language did you speak at home? English?
We spoke English and Greek were the primary ones. Even my dad learned some Greek because my mom was, you know, of course, she was born in Montreal, but grew up in Greece. And my grandparents were with us too, you know, living down the street. So they also spoke Greek fluently. They didn't really speak that much English. And, you know, so my dad was the only one from Iran here, besides the Iranian community of people who'd come, you know, before and after the revolution. He was really the only person of our family that was, you know, speaking Persian. So, of course, he didn't really speak that much at home. We mainly spoke English and Greek to communicate with all the other family members. Oh, yeah.
Right.
So for me, you know, making that decision, you know, traveling to California to go to school and then realizing, I got to pay for school, but decided to join the military. Of course, by the way, the military knew I was openly a Marxist. It was not a secret. This was like known. And I'll never forget a conversation I had with a superior officer. He came, you know, I went into his office, you know, did all the formalities and then sat down. And he said, I want you to know, I don't give a shit if you're a Marxist. Doesn't bother me. You know why? We defeated the Soviet Union. As long as you're not a radical Islamist, I don't care. You can be whatever you want.
Wow.
It was the best. I was like, well, at least you're honest. Okay. You know? So, you know, I commissioned as an officer in 2011 when I graduated. And then they wanted to send me over to Afghanistan. And I got out of the pipeline by going to seminary. So I went to the Greek Orthodox School of Theology, Holy Cross, in Brookline, Mass. And I slowly escaped that pipeline altogether. So I resigned my commission.
Wait.
Oh, yeah, I know. Talk about a trajectory.
So, okay, so a current Iranian and a Greek communist get together and they make you. And they produce an ML. And then this ML, in his late teens, decides to join the U.S. Imperial military, becomes an officer, you just said? You became you became an officer? And then and then you join the church? Get out of it.
I gotta tell you this. Okay, so before we're gonna discuss that background. So this is a really interesting phenomenon. This is an interesting thing because my dad's Shia, my mom's Greek Orthodox Christian. And so, of course, I didn't have any say over which religion I got. But there was a big discussion before I was born over what the children's religion would be, my brother and me. So, of course, my mom's like, I really want them to be Greek Orthodox. And my dad was like, okay, no problem. So people who wonder, we were seeing on Twitter, the not without my daughter. My dad was like totally fine. He's like, yeah, you want to be Orthodox Christian? Yeah, no problem. Doesn't bother me. It's like the totally opposite of what people think. Like somehow, oh, the father would want them to be Muslim. Yeah, my dad was like, I don't really care. Whatever you want them to be. We did go to mosque with my dad occasionally. But I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church. And it was actually a really important component because my grandmother especially was super religious, but she had sort of a liberation theology with her, Like Jesus was the first communist, this kind of stuff. It was very important, actually, for her. My grandfather, meh, okay, it's cultural. But so I grew up, really attached to my grandmother, to my yaya. So, of course, the church was super important. And then I quickly realized, boy, the church in America is super reactionary. And most people either support the monarchy or support the military junta. It's like all right wingers. I'm like, where's the left wing here? And one of the priests that was an assistant to our church was actually a professor of theology at the seminary. And he was liberation theologian. He was super awesome, ecumenical. He told me that my dad, because I always had these questions, growing up. I was like, well, does my dad have salvation being outside of, being unbaptized and outside the church? And he was like, yeah, of course. Every other priest would tell me, absolutely not. So I thought to myself, something's going on here. It wasn't until high school where I said, oh, I'm an atheist and I'm going to, leave the church. And then, of course, afterwards, I said, well, I got to get out of the military somehow. So the chaplain corps is the easiest way because you can go into the chaplain corps and then you can resign at any point without any penalties. So, I went to the military. I said, I had a vision from Jesus and he told me I have to pursue this. And of course, the commander was like, absolutely for God and country. So they changed me over to the chaplain corps. No problems. I had no issue. I thought to myself, well, that was easy. So I went to the seminary. I'll never forget. I walked into some classes with the badges of Lenin and this and that. I was totally ostracized for all the years I was there. It was absolutely great.
And you should have been.
I know. It was great. Although a few of the professors absolutely loved me because I really enjoyed, talking about especially historical theology and all this. I was interested in like religious syncretism. It's eventually what led me to be interested in anthropology of religion altogether. But, I was able to take classes at the Divinity School at Harvard, and I was able to kind of get out of the small, school community that we had at the Greek Orthodox school. And it was great. It was an opportunity and I reconnected with activists and people on the ground. And it was when I was there that I got a scholarship to go to China to study Marxist philosophy for 2 years. So I left the seminary, took a leave of absence, went to China, lived in China for 2 years, and got a master's in Marxist philosophy. From 2013 to 2015 as a China government scholar. So people are always joking. They're like, I have a Fulbright. I said, that's nice. I have a China government scholarship, the equivalent of a Fulbright in China.
But do they know that you're used to be in the military?
They didn't really care. Yeah, of course they knew. It didn't bother them because at that time, Obama, okay, there was the ratcheting up of the tensions in the Pacific. But, I was basically like, yeah, I'm on inactive reserves and I'm, and of course, it was while I was in China that I realized that actually the U.S. Naval Academy had a program. They were sending people over to learn Chinese and things like that. So there were exchanges between, actually formal exchanges between military academies and military officers back and forth. But I don't know what that's like. Might not even exist anymore, given the current situation with sort of the ratcheting up of tensions. With China. So I lived in China for 2 years. And when I returned, I resigned my commission. And it was no problem. Literally the same day, I said, I resigned my commission as a conscientious objector. And they were like, oh, okay, honorable discharge. There you go. You're out of here. That's myself. Wow. Okay, that's great.
So you never fired a bullet?
No. Never fired. I only got trained, which is also great, too. We need some comrades with some training. You know what I'm saying? It's important. So, yeah, I never fired a bullet, never was deployed with the U.S. Army, never did anything like that. So I just basically went in there, put on the uniform, got training, left, and never served overseas, anything like that. Never wanted to either. But hey, I got school paid for, so I'm totally fine, you know. If there wasn't a need to pay for education, of course, most people wouldn't do that route. But it's difficult. It's difficult, as you know, of course. The education here and the prices of school. So I made that decision. Of course, some comrades still, you know, will never let that die. So that's okay.
I mean, I'll it's an it. Imperial military apparatus.
Well, of course it is. Of course it is. I'm not saying
but
it
what
is.
Did your brain, but your brain was like, I'm going to just do this?
Well, my brain had other ideas too. Like maybe some point Red Army, you know, we need to have some people, you know, in strategic places.
So were you like a gun nut?
Was I a gun nut? I mean, I like learning about, you know, guns and arms and things like that. That served me very well in Syria, I tell you that much.
I know, but was it like a kind of aesthetic love of guns? Because sometimes it's that.
No. It wasn't. You mean for why I would join?
No, like why? But of all the things to join the military, like that's, I mean, especially at that time, because this was in the aftermath of Bush, right? And also
it was
before
just after
the withdrawal.
Bush. 2007, it was just after. It was like,
he's still president.
No, yeah, I know. I know. Actually, I was in, I had joined the military right at the end of the Bush administration when Obama was elected. So yeah, of course. I mean,
so when it was clear that the whole Iraq thing wasn't working out as planned, you decided to join the U.S. military.
Oh yeah. Of course, and of course, I was vocal about my opposition to the war. And in fact, I found a lot of people who had been there who were like, "Yeah, it was an absolute nightmare. Saddam was much better than this." And I thought to myself, "Oh, okay. Well, at least some people are bright around here." But I, you know, for me, given the options that I had, I made that decision. And, you know, I can say that, yes, big mistake, but also one positive was learning all the things that I learned. And, you know, I didn't go overseas. They wanted me to go to Afghanistan. I said, absolutely not. You know, I have nothing against those people. They never did anything to me. Afghans are like brothers and sisters to Iranians over there. I'm going to go there and they're going to kill me because they're going to say traitor, this and that, double traitor, you know. So... I said, no, absolutely not. I won't do that. And I didn't have to go. So eventually in that arc, so I resigned from the military. And it was in that time that I'm slowly, you know, coming to an anarchist sort of viewpoint and understanding.
How old are you at this point?
Ooh, well, how old was I? I was 26, 27. So I'm coming to this, you know, sort of vision of what needs to be done and okay, organizing, blah, blah, blah. You know, everybody is talking about theory and this and that. So of course, eventually, you know, it's late 2015 and we're watching what's going on in Northeast Syria, watching, you know, just, you know, Kobani had just happened and we're watching the quote unquote heroic resistance of the Kurdish peoples against ISIS. And of course, we know that the US is beginning the campaign to help them. Right, aerial, you know, bombardment.
Help ISIS.
Yes. Well, we knew that too. But you know, absolutely has hands in all sides, even in the groups that ISIS was against on the jihadist side. So, you know, eventually, you know, with the anarchist position, I said, okay, fuck everybody. I'm gonna go there. I'm Kurdish. Got to go there and fight for my people. So I go to Greece, and it was there where I, you know, lived for about a year. Before I went over in 2016. And it was there where I started getting connected with working with Kurdish refugees and working with organizations that had close ties to the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK. And it was...
So, you went through Diyarbakir, right? Or I don't know how to say it.
Diyarbakir? No. Yeah. Okay, whoa, hold on. Before we get there, I'll set the scene and then we'll talk about where I went through, because this is interesting.
Because I know about that town from conferences. There were anarchists. There was a pipeline from Berlin to that town, which I always want to say Diyarbakir. There was like a strange sort of human pipeline of people.
That
and
is,
they would anybody who was remotely interested, and that was 2008, 2009.
Yes. Okay. So true. That is true. And so what? So basically, that pipeline closed by the time we basically 2016, the middle of 2016, that pipeline closed. Why? Why? Because Turkey's military and then Turkish-backed FSA, Free Syrian Army, invaded northeast Syria and took over the major city of Al-Bab, and you know, was starting to push towards Manbij, which is where the Manbij operation comes in 2016. And that area was controlled by Daesh, by ISIS, but the Turkish government knew that there was a pipeline, of course, and they cut that off. So basically, the border I'm talking about, a wall unimaginable from one side of northwest Syria to northeast Syria, is just a massive concrete barrier that the Turks built to prevent, especially fighters, especially those who are sympathetic to the Kurds, anarchists, communists, whatever, coming in. And Diyarbakir was a main area because Diyarbakir is a very important Kurdish city, and it has a massive resistance against the Turkish state. It had like a basically PKK youth offshoots that were fighting basically street warfare against the Turkish military and police forces. And you can see online pictures and images at that time. But that was a huge pipeline. That was closed. So there was no option for us to go through Turkey. The other comrades had gone through Turkey before. One comrade who went...
That's also over... how a lot of jihadis went through Turkey,
absolutely.
Right? Like that was also... It was the same pipeline.
Absolutely. And actually, what's interesting is the pipeline for the people who went for solidarity and fighting with the Kurds closed. The pipeline for jihadis didn't close. that remained open. Yeah. So basically, some of the comrades that had been before I went had gone through Turkey, and then we realized that was closed. So what we ended up doing after I trained, learned Kurmanji, worked with the PKK leadership in Europe, eventually got on a plane in Sweden. Of course, Sweden, very interesting history. A lot of Kurds there. The Swedish government originally blamed the PKK for the assassination of Prime Minister Olaf Palme, if you remember. They were the main suspects, even though my hunch, along with many others, is that the South African apartheid regime had something to do with it. And local fascists, but that's okay. They put it straight on the Kurds. It was like, well, why would you kill Palme? In fact, he's like a comrade more than anything else. So went to Stockholm, met up with some comrades there, and then flew over to Sulaymaniyah, in the north of Iraq, right, to Iraqi Kurdistan, and flew to Sulaymaniyah. And while I was there, I realized that everybody was there, not only the Kurds, Komala, KDPI, all of the Iranian Kurdish rebel groups were also in the area. So I thought to myself, oh boy, this is like the gathering of all the different rebel groups in the region. We went up to the mountains.
What's the date of this?
So this would be January 2017.
Right.
Yeah. So January 2017, I land in...
But did you know what Syria had become at that point, the so-called Syrian civil war? Where were you? What was your position? Or you was just tunnel vision, or like not tunnel vision in a bad way, but in a real, I mean, your family is Kurdish. You have, uh-huh. Like, I don't begrudge you for, I mean, not that I, who the hell am I to begrudge anyone? But the reason why I sound skeptical, it's not skeptical per se, but like you knew what was going on in Syria, this sort of operation. But for you, the priority was, like, I have to do this.
Well, for me at that point, being an anarchist, I was much more in like the burning country camp. That was the people I was around.
Oh, you were pro-rebel at that point. That makes sense.
Well,
yeah.
Well, we were basically, we were pro the quote-unquote democratic opposition, all these, you know, anarchist groups that were so-called existing there. Even, you know, at some of the meetings in Greece that we went to, there were various Trotskyist groups that were in some areas that were still fighting.
Of course.
So it was basically like, of course, you know, let's not get into the Trotskyites.
The usual suspects.
So basically,
all of these people who were excited to Balkanize Syria, right?
Absolutely.
Like that's part of...
Absolutely. So the idea, at least, that's why I tell you, it wasn't until I got on the ground where I realized, holy shit, I've been pilled. This is crazy. I'd like totally... From people sometimes like joke and they say high schoolers have no clue what they're talking about. I said I had a more more strong anti-imperialist position as a high schooler than I do now. You know?
Well, I mean, what happens when you join the military, man?
I'm telling you, it gets crazy.
You camo-pilled yourself.
So basically, I go, we're in these meetings. So let me give you a background. So we're in these meetings, and Burning Country was the main thing. A lot of anarchists saying, you know, Assad is basically
When you say burn the country, by the way, you should explain. There's a phrase, Assad, or we burn the country. And it's a phrase that's a, right?
Yeah. Yes. Basically, what happened is this. So you have on the left at that point, like give you, you know, sort of, you were there, you know, in terms of the what was going on at the time. You basically had two camps. Actually, I would say three camps altogether. You had the camp that was pro-Damascus, pro-President Assad, that was saying that this is a regime change war. And a lot of people that we love and respect had different positions over the course of the civil war. It took a while for some of us to come to the conclusion. It took me actually fighting in Syria to realize, holy shit, this is World War III. This isn't just, you know, some civil war in some backwater country on the other side of the world. This is World War III. Everybody's here. Everybody's involved. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, this is not what anybody was talking about on the anarchist side of the equation. And so you have the position we start out with, okay, pro-Assad. That was, you know, the classic sort of anti-imperialist, the communist parties, workers' parties, a lot of this position. Okay. Then you have the position of the moderate rebels. There are some good people in the war that we have to support. There are some, either just a moderate jihadis all the way to like a pacifist anarchist that are being bombarded by, Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian Arab army. And we have to support them. Then you had the side that was like, we are just going to... Or actually, you know what? You also had a small sliver of people who said that ISIS was anti-imperialist, you know, Spartacus League and all this
what?
Stuff. Oh,
what?
My God, I got to send you a link.
What?
Yes. There was a Trotskyite group that said that ISIS was anti-imperialist and must be supported. I love it.
I'm going to put an ice pick sound effect right here. I'm making a note. Timeline footnote. Ice pick sound effect right here.
I'm telling you. It was crazy. And then you had the other side that was basically supporting only Rojava. They said, okay, we are supporting the Kurdish liberation struggle. It's a social revolution, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
What's Rojava? Tell people what Rojava is.
So Rojava is the name for what is basically the western province of...
It means west in Kurdish, right?
And it basically identifies an area that to Kurdish nationalists is the western part of a greater Kurdistan. And so that area includes northeast Syria. It includes what's basically now the cantons of Jazira, Kobani, and now Afrin, which is occupied by Turkey. And there's a lot of disagreement amongst Kurdish nationalists as to the actual borders of Kurdistan. For example, I know that Malayer for the PKK, where my dad was born, belongs in Kurdistan. But for Kurdish nationalists in Iraqi Kurdistan, like the Barzani types, no, we fall outside of Kurdistan. Therefore, we don't identify as Kurdish. So it's actually all over the place. This is the beauty of a project in development, quote-unquote. And that's why there are a lot of actors involved in that project's development. So we have the anarchist position and sort of like other leftists as well, even some communists and socialists who say, okay, Rojava is a project worth fighting for and supporting. And within that camp, there are people who are pro-Rojava, who are also pro-Assad, pro-Hezbollah, pro- Quds Force, all this stuff, very interesting. Those are the people that I met over there. And then in this camp,
those
you have
people called lying to themselves.
Well, those are the people
that's the thing, right? Like the idea of an ethno state, right? Like that's what Rojava is. It's an ethno state proposed to be carved out of already existing national state entities.
Yes.
So, like,
true.
That's called revolution. That's called, and in reality, like, that's a violent revolution. You're breaking away. I mean, put aside the sort of autonomous the autonomous sort of relation, the relationship of sort of autonomous autonomy for between the Syrian governments and Kurdish populations. Okay, like we can talk about those things, but in general, what in reality it meant a lot of foreigners coming to a place where they're not from and fighting to break a country away from another larger country, which just so happens to be our enemy.
100% true. Did we understand that at the time? Partially. But it wasn't clear. You know why? I'll tell you why. The comrades on the ground sold it like this. We are allied with the Americans, just like Stalin was allied with the Americans during World War II. And I thought to myself, that's an interesting comparison, except that Assad isn't Hitler or Benito Mussolini. Yeah. You know,
yeah, exactly.
So you can't really make that comparison.
You can tell that that argument was crafted someplace like west of the Elba or whatever. Like it was not because it imagines the world in this easy, nice analogy that's nice and clean. And in the end, it's always the despot, the Oriental despot, who by any means necessary, even if it's ugly, needs to be overthrown in the name of democracy. I mean, this is the just Machiavellian logic of regime changers that I never understand. And the story of Rojava, however, is, I mean, it's complicated. Like the Kurdish national question is a question that we all need to engage seriously. It's an old one. It's one that's pressing. It has to do with other broad questions. However, its iteration in the form of Rojava, whatever its origins, whoever wanted to do it first, or whatever people on the ground who sincerely believe in it may think, the reality is that it has become a tool for exploiting regional tensions and, like for centuries before, very much part of the dominate, conquer, and balkanize, or balkanize, dominate, or dominate, balkanize, conquer, and turn that into a kind of nice vassal hub. I mean, my God, the Americans coined the term SDF. That was by an American general.
Do you know why? Do you know why? This is interesting. Do you know why they
put the word democracy in it? Because it sounds nice?
No. Because the American government, and this is what I know because I'm followed now, as you've seen, I'm on watch lists and everything like that because I went, not only because I went over there, because I had such a close relationship with the PKK. The PKK for NATO is a terrorist organization. The U.S. listed
because of the Turks,
Exactly, because it's actually fighting a war against NATO. This is why I'm telling you, this cognitive dissonance was immense. You have a Kurdistan Workers' Party that was supported by Hafez al-Assad, who was based in Damascus. I mean, Abdullah Öcalan, the leader who's imprisoned on the island of İmralı in Turkey right now, was supported by Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father. The PKK was supported by the Soviet Union, and the Soviet question was in every single Communist Party of the Soviet Union Congress until the end of the Soviet Union. Basically,
the Kurdish question.
Absolutely. And the PKK was supported by the Warsaw Pact, for sure. I mean, all the equipment, everything they have is from Hungary, East Germany, Poland, all over. They funneled weapons in the 80s, in the 80s and 90s through Turkey to the mountains, coming from the Eastern Bloc. And what's more interesting is that the PKK actively fought against Israel during the war in Lebanon and has martyrs on the side of the Palestinian cause. So now you have a PKK that finds itself. This history, this backdrop is important because it shows the complexity of the situation. You have a PKK that was ML, right? A Marxist-Leninist organization. Had the hammer and sickle on its flag. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it loses its biggest sponsor, right? And so it finds itself in Syria, based in Damascus, with the Kurds in Syria being the primary pipeline to the mountains fighting against Turkey. And of course, Hafez al-Assad loves that because Hafez al-Assad was pro-Soviet, right? Was supported by the Soviet Union. And then after finds himself enmeshed in a new world order where the US and NATO are expanding. So Turkey finds itself in the 90s strengthening itself. And so he realizes that he uses the PKK as a proxy to fight against Turkey. Well, late 90s come and Turkey says, we're going to invade Syria if you don't get rid of Öcalan. And so Hafez al-Assad has to have Öcalan expelled from Syria to prevent a war with Turkey. Turkey literally amassed its army on the borders and said, if you don't get rid of Öcalan and the PKK, we're going to come in. So Hafez al-Assad says, okay, Öcalan's gone. So Öcalan leaves the base in Damascus, travels around Europe, ends up in Kenya at the Greek consulate, because actually the Greeks were secretly supporting, even though they're in NATO, they were secretly supporting the PKK in a proxy war with Turkey, of course. I mean, Greeks and Turks, they don't get along, you know, as you know. So they were supporting. And of course, in the mix, this is why it's important to know the whole scenario. You know who else was with the PKK fighting? Asala, the Armenian secret army for the liberation of Armenia. Here you have Monty Melkonian and a lot of guerrillas fighting in Lebanon. And then afterwards, Kurds fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh in the first war. So a lot of the people that I interacted with in Northeast Syria had fought in Nagorno-Karabakh against the Azeris on the side of the Armenians. And I thought to myself, holy, oh my gosh, I'm in the midst of all of this. You know, everything comes down to all of these complexities in the region. And so you have all these alliances and they shift. And so Öcalan is captured in a joint operation, CIA, Mossad, and MIT, which is why it's very interesting. Öcalan is captured with the help of Mossad because Öcalan was pro-Palestinian. They had links with PFLP and all these different groups, right? So he's captured while he's in prison. Actually, a little bit before, in the 90s, he starts changing his mind. He says, okay, well, the Soviet Union's gone. Maybe we shouldn't go for...
Yeah, they caved. I mean, Öcalan caved.
He caved. Like, I'm telling you, pre-90s, PKK, awesome. What an organization. After that, becomes revisionist, fully. And basically, he says, okay, well, and you know what he starts doing? He starts doing the thing that I did. He gets pilled by reading Michel Foucault, all these people. He starts going into that.
The humanities ruined him.
Oh my God, I'm telling you. He starts reading all this stuff, and then he reads Murray Bookchin. Worst move ever. He reads Murray Bookchin, who's also a Vermonter, by the way. So he starts reading Murray Bookchin, and then he has this idea, this synthesis called democratic confederalism, which comes into being in the 2000s while he's in prison. And within this time, a lot of people left the PKK. You should know that the MLs, that, like, by the way, they still sing songs in praise of Stalin in the PKK. Don't think they don't.
They still sing Bella Ciao at protests.
Absolutely. I'm telling you, revolutionary songs, number one in the PKK. I mean, the song Stalin was...
All that's left, though. That's all that's left.
That's
They're
all
now
that's
in the
left. I know. It's true.
The
it's
Americans
true.
Now they, it's now true. They just are quizzlings for the Americans. Like,
well,
okay.
You know what's interesting? You know what's interesting about that? This here, listen to this. The PKK in northern Iraq are bombed daily by the Turks with the help of the Americans and the Israelis. Once the PKK cross the border into Syria, they're opened with wide arms and they're given arms. Those arms eventually end up in the north of Iraq and then eventually used against Turkish equipment also provided by the U.S. I'm telling you, it's the Iranian war all over again.
This is the goal. You have everybody fighting and you profit off of all of it. And
all of it.
It proves your point that these people are warlike.
Absolutely.
It's like the best strategy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I get there, with this backdrop, I end up realizing that there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on because people know, like when we were in the mountains in Gare, so the Gare Mountains are basically at the border between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Those are the mountains where the PKK now has strong bases. Not only the PKK, 9 other communist and worker parties of Turkey that have guerrilla formations. So you can think of the Turkish Communist Party, Marxist-Leninist, the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party, the Revolutionary Communist Party, all these different parties. They have their bases as well because there's an overarching structure. It's Hebedehash in Turkish, but it's basically like the people's revolutionary, you know, sort of front against the Turkish fascism. And so it's all these different parties with the PKK at the head, and they're fighting a guerrilla war against Turkey. But then they all come into Northeast Syria where they're supplied and supported by the Americans and the coalition against ISIS. And they have their bases there. The Americans don't like the fact that they're there. By the way, we knew that while we were there, that the Americans were telling the Kurdish leadership, because I was privy to some of these conversations, that they didn't like any of the hammer and sickles or anarchist A's or anything like that in Northeast Syria, because it complicated
their
relationship.
But they helped them, though. But it helped them, though.
Absolutely.
It made them look sexier.
Absolutely, it did. They liked it in the background. They didn't want them actively fighting because they knew that there was a boomerang, which is why now I'm on that list, which is basically that all these people are going to get trained in combat, all this stuff, then come home and still realize that the U.S. and fascism and all this stuff are the enemies, right?
They'll be like those Japanese soldiers who don't know World War II ended.
Exactly. They're just keeping on in the jungles of the Philippines, you know? So this was interesting. So we get there and slowly start to realize, oh my gosh, you know, this conflict is not as easy or cookie cutter as, you know, the left was, as some aspects of the left, you know, some groups were saying. This is a lot more complicated because Syrian Arab Army controlled areas still in Northeast Syria. So I interacted with SAA. I interacted with people who had the banner of, you know, Bashar al-Assad and, you know, the various other parties and formations on that side of the war. And I thought to myself, well, we're on the same side here too. So the Americans are here and the coalition. SAA is here. FSA Northern Sun, which was also supportive of, you know, it was FSA that eventually split and went to supporting Rojava.
This is the Free Syrian Army.
You're right. This is the Free Syrian Army, but the Northern Sun grouping, which actually left the FSA broader and went to support the struggle in Rojava. So they actually ended up becoming U.S.-backed, but on the other side of the equation. So I'm telling you, it got really complicated. There were groups that were pro-ISIS that ended up switching and became pro-SDF because of how the situation changed. I mean, total opportunism. I love it. It was great. We met some of these people.
Well, there were also, a lot of them were mercenaries. So it doesn't matter who you fight for. You're making money and you're getting an EU passport out of it.
I'll never forget. We detained, of course. We were, you know, on the front line, so we detained six young boys. And I'll never forget, we were talking to this one guy. He must have been 16, 17, and I'm thinking to myself, this is ISIS. What the hell is this? So we thought we were fighting all these, like, you know, the Chechen rebels, you know, big beards, burly men, you know, gonna come and blow us all up. These were like kids fighting with a Kalashnikov. They were given force there in their villages to fight against, you know, massive air power. I mean, we'll talk about that in a second. But they talked to the kid. The kid said, if the Christians were paying us, we would gladly fight for them too. I mean, we just need money. We have nothing. And that's myself, damn, forget about, you know, it's just, it wasn't even like the media was portraying it. It was so different over there. So when we got on the front line, I got on the front line in end of April, beginning of May 2017. This is phase four of the Raqqa operation. Basically, the coalition and the SDF were still outside of the city of Raqqa proper by about 40 kilometers, 30, 40 kilometers, 50 in some other places. Basically, we're still a little bit ways out. So I get on the front line, and I'm telling you one thing. The first time we got in a firefight with Daesh, I was shitting my pants. I mean, this was brutal. I'm talking about homemade mortars, IEDs, vehicle-borne IEDs, suicide bombers, Dochka. I mean, think about this. Anti-aircraft weapons used against infantry or against, you know, any sort of ground personnel is a violation of the laws of war. It's illegal. Everybody did it in the war. So everybody has an anti-aircraft gun, which is, you know, we're talking about a bullet that would blow you into smithereens. And they're shooting at each other. So they're shooting at us with anti-aircraft weapon. I'm telling you, I couldn't find a hole, you know, deep enough to crawl into. It was petrifying. And they had classic drones.
So how did you get into a firefight? Like, what's occurring around you?
So basically, we got to a frontline position. And what they would do is they would...
Who's leading you, though? Who's guiding you?
So basically... I was a member of what's called the International Freedom Battalion, which is basically all these other communist groups from Turkey and Kurdistan that were basically an umbrella organization next to the YPG, but under its leadership in terms of military. But it had a separate structure altogether. Right. So because they were from the communist parties in Turkey, so they took orders from the mountains, basically from the leadership in the higher circles of the wider struggle. So they didn't necessarily, we only took orders from the YPG in terms of military issues, but in terms of organization and things like that, they took from, you know, orders from their own parties. So we got there on the front lines and we were placed there by YPG who gave us a point.
Who's in with you?
So there are Turkish communists, Kurdish communists, and then other internationals, international communists, anarchists, socialists of all types. So
is this like a platoon?
Yeah, it's basically a battalion, if you think of it that way.
How big was it?
How big was it? So we had a few hundred total in the IFB. And at one point on the front, you had about 30 to 40, guerrillas. So basically a company, a platoon style formation. So if you think about that, we had 30 or 40 in a village that would normally have maybe upwards of 100 plus total. But in this particular operation, we found ourselves basically alone in some of these villages. In fact, I'll tell you in a second, in one of the villages, there were only six of us. And I'll tell you what happened there. But so basically, we get on the front and at nighttime, the attacks didn't happen. It's not like the movies, first and foremost. The war is not like the movies at all. It's not daytime and everybody's looking at each other and bayonet. No, no, this was nighttime, sandstorms, inclement weather. This was basically fighting happened at the worst times or the most opportune times to pick a shot. So the first time I experienced the fighting was at nighttime, middle of the night, 3-4 a.m. That's a classic time to attack. Early, you know why? Because everybody's tired. Everybody's tired. You got like, you know, 4 or 5 people on watch looking. They get tired. Some might fall asleep up there and boom, ISIS makes the attack and, you know, a couple suicide bombers in there and the whole platoon's gone. That's it. The whole grouping. So it was nighttime. All of us are awakened. Gunshots, this, that. Everybody's running around like crazy. And it subsides. That's it. You know, it's a firefight here, there. In the daytime, they attacked us a couple times. I was actually on the, you know, building basically trench, this, that. You know, we're building all these kind of protection for our points. You know, to if we're going to get in a firefight. And then they started shooting at me because I was in a place where they could see me. So a couple hundred meters, you know, away in some little hut, they were started shooting at me with a PKM. I telling you, I flew down to escape. But you could hear those over your head. And that's the bullets flying by.
Like in PUBG, man.
I'm telling you, oh my gosh.
It's like a video game. You're actually doing the video game thing.
And of course, the scariest were the homemade mortars, because you just heard these things fly over you. You didn't know where they were going. So you literally couldn't get deep enough.
A mortar is a big bullet.
No. So a mortar is basically, imagine an explosive that's
it's a big
fired
bomb like, that you can throw in the air.
Right. It's basically, you basically drop it into a tube or you can launch it through basically some sort of vertical, you know, like a tube. You put it in a tube or you put it on a rail system and you can fire it and it goes into the air and it's inaccurate as hell. You know, you don't know. I mean, the military ones are more accurate, but these ones were homemade. So they basically, you don't know where they land and they're homemade. They're like propane canisters and all that kind of stuff. So you just hear them whooshing over your head and you're praying that they don't land near you. Because these things go off and they'd like take down a house. So they would fly over our head. In this particular operation, when Daesh attacked us on another night, we heard the Americans coming in. I'm telling you, you cannot imagine what it's like to hear a jet fighter go overhead and then drop munitions on these Daesh fighters coming in. I mean, I don't know. It's just overwhelming, and is all I can, is the best way I can describe it. I mean, we're talking about.
Did you know they were coming in? Like, were you forewarned of it?
So they'll, on the radio, we have contact with basically what was our headquarters, which had a map that they had communications with the coalition. And they would tell them where we were at. That wasn't always accurate. Sometimes people would get mistakes and the coalition attacked a lot of SDF targets as well by accident. Killed a lot of people, a lot of comrades as well in the struggle. So it was by accident. Who knows? You know what I mean? These things have precision up to like a meter. So I don't know how accidental it was, but there you go. So we had,
because I've heard other people who fought in similar situations of a certain tablet that they had a tablet.
That was a tablet. So it was basically these tablets that they were given that they had a map. I don't know if you know Live UA map. It basically was like that. It's a map that showed where everybody was with the latest intelligence, and then you could plot in points, and then those were synced with the coalition and the air force or whoever was up there, the Navy pilots or Marine pilots. They were up there and they got the information, and then they were, you know, give with that information they would find the targets and destroy them. Now, I want you to know, a lot of people use those tablets to destroy everything. They say, Daesh is there, because they knew that once the coalition was done with the bombing, we had to go in. So instead of meeting resistance or supposed resistance, why not just blow the whole thing up? Just have the coalition go in there and destroy everything. So
nice when you're not from there, huh? It doesn't really matter.
well, this was all, of course, you know, absolutely. So the Kurdish leadership, you know, would just say, all right, you know, get rid of the whole area. And, you know, and this was apparent to me when we moved. So after we were in that first location, we eventually did a 16-kilometer push in one night. And overhead, so there were refugees coming in front of us. So we were meeting people on the road. And that was also nerve-wracking because you don't know if there are, like, everybody was worried about sleeper cells and this and that. So you're always on guard. You don't know what's going on. And of course, civilians were killed accidentally or purposely. I don't know. I mean, I'm not in the heads of the other people, but we know.
There's videos of ISIS doing suicide bombings on civilians. They love terrorizing civilians. That's how they got them out of their place. I mean, that's what
absolutely. But also on our side too. Like, for example, there'd be civilians coming, and of course people would get nervous up on the roof, or they had actual animosity. They just open up on them. Oh yeah, it happened, of course. And I'll tell you, when we went into this push, I was carrying almost 1,000 rounds of ammunition, very, very heavy, you know, about 40 pounds on my back, plus gun, plus, you know, all the rifle. I had the AK, AKM, and had all this equipment. So we're marching 16 kilometers, and eventually we get to another village. And there we are outside, we're outside of the village, and we know that Daesh is there. So we have a team come to help us, and they're on they have the pad and everything, the radios, and then all of a sudden Daesh begins attacking because they see that they're being surrounded now. We're all moving into this village. So they start shooting RPGs over our heads because RPG, like an RPG grenade. You know, the RPG is the grenade launcher, right? Like the classic one that they, you know, all the terrorists, you know, the East is red, you know, sort of, you know, you have the RPG. And so the warhead has an internal detonator that will detonate after a certain distance, right? So they were just shooting them over our heads so they would detonate above us in the air and, you know, rain down shrapnel and you know, hopefully kill us or harm us. So that starts happening. We pull back. And eventually what happens is, you know, guy on the radio and the tablet, they send up the coordinates. I'm telling you, this village had a 3-story school. Most village, by the way, props to the Assad government. Every village had a school, and a beautiful school at that. I mean, we don't even have schools in our town in Vermont. Everyone over there had schools. So this village had like a 3-story school. It was the biggest structure in the village. And the Kurdish leadership with us thought that Daesh was in the school. That's where the fire was coming from. So the coalition went in there and went right overhead. And I'm telling you, that school went down as fast as you can imagine. Huge explosion. And then the school collapsed. And we waited until early morning to begin the operation again. When we went in there, and we were the first team to go in, I mean, that was my first sight of dead humans in war. I mean, we're talking about, you know, burnt corpses and dismembered bodies and things like that. And we got into the village and, you know, we had to check some of these people too for IEDs and explosives. Sometimes they would die and they'd leave grenades underneath them. So if you turn them over, they would explode and you would be killed as well. So we had to check them and, you know, do all that, which, you know, take ammunition. I mean, it was full on guerrilla warfare. I mean, we're talking about all weapons and ammunition, anything we could use, we took. And while I was walking in the village, we realized that there was a plastic bag. You know, me and another Heval, another comrade, were walking, and we realized there's a plastic bag next to a concrete telephone pole. And we said, stop. And it was an IED. Had we had gone further, we would have tripped the wire. The bag would have exploded, and the concrete telephone pole would have come on our heads. So we realized that, and we were able to came, you know, we have, every group has somebody who knows bombs, like bomb technician. So they came and they were able to defuse the IED. And we occupied that village, and it was while in the village, while we were clearing the village, that we caught basically six young boys. It was six young boys, and there were a few older guys there too.
Were they Syrian?
They were Syrian. Oh yeah, they were just local Arab villagers. But because they were on the ISIS side and they were armed, but they totally, no resistance, they gave up, no problem. And one of the Hevals in our group said, I want to kill them all now. He had been fighting since Kobani. So he had a lot of PTSD. The guy should have gone on a vacation and never returned to the front line, because I'm telling you, war fucks you up. It dehumanizes, and it's completely not normal to see this stuff every day, nonstop, to be in a constant state of, oh my God, am I going to die? Or does somebody else have to die? And, you know, I got to be at the ready, and I got to make sure that I'm like, you know, the trigger ready to, you know, kill anything that comes, you know, that's going to harm me or harm my comrades. So it's totally not normal. And so some of these people who'd been in the conflict for years, they were messed up. A lot of them were messed up. Some of them weren't. Some of them were, you know, we'll talk about those types too. But some of them were, you know, ready to commit crimes too, because they just hated the enemy so much that they would even kill civilians that were caught in between. So we prevented that with a big fight. We prevented that. We took these the boys and some of the older men. We took them, and eventually we gave them over to the Kurdish forces. Would come on motorcycles and they'd take them one at a time, and they would bring them to the back. And what they did with them, I don't know. They told us that they would, you know, imprison them and then interrogate them. What that consisted of, I don't know. I never saw it, and I never saw where they went. They just took them away. So we occupied this village, and later on, after about a day, so the next day, we're in this village, and of course, we haven't taken the whole village yet, mind you. We're still like halfway. The village was pretty big. And then all of a sudden, some firefight breaks out. There was some other ISIS people that had gone underground, and we found tunnel systems and all that stuff. So, boom, called the coalition. Within, I'm telling you, it was on the other side of the village. The Americans came, dropped the bomb into what's called danger close. Like, I'm telling you, we saw the house go up in the air and the shockwave, and it was petrifying because, I mean, this is a huge munition. The house went up in the air, and that was the end of ISIS resistance in the village. We took the whole village. We spent another night there, and then the following day, they brought in military vehicles, you know, sort of armored personnel carriers. We jumped in them, and then we went on to the next push. The next push was very scary because now we were entering within the 5-kilometer range of the city proper. So this was industrial facilities. There was a sugar factory in our area. There were other, you know, sort of industrial facilities that were, I mean, it was a sprawling site, so you didn't know where Daesh was. The Americans spared no bomb. They just launched everything. They decimated everything. And also, it was at this time that I heard, mind you, before us, we had, we saw drones, Apaches, and, you know, the jets that would come in, whether they were F-16s, F-18s, F-22s, I don't know. But above us, they'd come in and they would drop the bombs. Now we had the A-10. Now the A-10 has that, like a Gatling gun in front of it. And it sounds like a giant, imagine a zipper, but imagine a zipper in the sky that's so loud. That's what it sounds like. It's like, and so it's basically this Gatling gun lighting up everything in its sights. So we would get to this industrial facility as we're walking towards the area, nighttime, mind you, and we would hear that. And it was the A-10 above us shooting up whatever it could in front of us to pave the way. And the more, now mind you, the more I'm going in this, the more I'm like, boy, this isn't really a revolution. You know, in a revolution, you don't really have an imperial power giving you all of this support. So, you know, I start getting a little bit, you know, cold feet about the whole thing. So eventually we take a small village point. After that morning, we eventually take a small village point and we pass a massive area where some of the Kurdish Hevals had told us that ISIS had done executions. And we could see that it was a perfect area. It looks like a decimated construction area and sort of a big industrial facility. But this is where I can't know for sure. We'd have to go back and check videos and, you know, geolocate. But this was an area that they said they threw people off roofs and things like that. So mind you, we're in the heart of it now. We're in the source of, you know, sort of the quote-unquote caliphate's capital. We get to this small village and there's only six of us in the team now. And we have to take a point. And we are separated by the other Hevals by a kilometer plus. So we have this point on the front line against Daesh. And we have only six of us on the front. And of course, the village had, I think, total 15, 20 houses. So we go through every house looking for mines or anything like that that would, you know, harm us. And then we have to start taking food, supplies, anything we can get because, I mean, you got to also think about in war logistics. How did we get food? How did we get water? How did we get all this stuff? It's brought by, you know, people on motorcycles or things like that. And if they don't have it and if they can't bring it because it's too dangerous or treacherous, we're on our own. We're whatever supplies we have and whatever we can scrounge. So we break into every house and take whatever we could because that was the only way to survive. It was, I'm telling you, total war. So we get to the
village. The villages are empty?
The villages are empty, completely empty. Yeah, everybody had taken everything that they wanted and left behind everything that they couldn't take. So we took mattresses, pillows, blankets, you know, of course, that's how we slept. We took people's blankets and pillows and mattresses and, you know, anything we could. And we would put them on the roofs. And that's where we would sleep. We'd sleep on the roof. And the first night we were in this village, I heard the call to prayer from Raqqa. And it wasn't only a traditional call to prayer, you know. It was a call to prayer plus Daesh propaganda and, you know, sort of a pep talk and a rally all together. And we could see the city. I mean, the city was basically just 3-4 kilometers from us. And if I tell you how nervous we were, because, I mean, you got to think about it. In front of us is a city that claims to be the capital of the so-called caliphate of the Islamic State. And there are six of us holding this point on the front line. And we're a bunch of internationals and Turkish and Kurdish communists. And we're supposed to hold off this. I mean, holy moly. I mean, we were petrified. And the next day, we experienced the first surge of refugees. So basically between our village and behind us, where the other Kurdish forces were, you know, positioning themselves, we had to basically be a block to the refugees and check them when they were coming. Hundreds came. And there were only, mind you, six of us, you know? So I'm thinking to myself, how are we going to do this? Like, how are we going to check all these people? Nobody was even fluent in Arabic. I mean, people were fluent in Turkish and Kurdish and some Arabic. But nobody was fluent in Arabic to speak to these villagers and these people from the city of Raqqa who were leaving. And
they had a rainbow flag, man. They had a rainbow flag. Couldn't they just feed them the rainbow flag of justice and tell them that this was a
democratic movement? I'm telling you, and a lot of the people were, you know, a lot of the women were fully covered, niqab, you know, full. And we go up there and comrades didn't know what to do. Now started like, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to let them go. We're not going to let them go. We got to call leadership. We don't know what to do. So I go down there with three other comrades, you know, salam alaikum, you know, this and that. And an old man comes, kisses me. I thought to myself, okay, well, that was nice. And then everybody starts giving us some stuff, this, that. So some of the comrades were ready to just open up. They said, we don't know. Daesh might be in there. We got to protect ourselves. They didn't do anything. If Daesh was there, they didn't hurt us. They totally were fine. The people were fine. we let them all pass. And so a convoy basically was created. Thousands of people by the time we left there. Thousands of refugees had gone through our checkpoint and had gone to the rear. So we experienced that. And I remember very vividly, there was a car that was very suspicious, that was going back and forth on the front line. And we thought it was possibly Daesh checking our locations and possibly a V-bed. So I was on the roof with a PKM. A PKM is like a squad, basically a larger machine gun that's used in squads. And it's a bigger gun. It's the same caliber as an AK, but it's more powerful. So I'm up there with the PKM, and the comrades tell me to open fire on the car. So the car is maybe about, I'd say, 500 to 600 meters from me. So I look through the iron sights, and I open up with a burst of shots at the car, and the car doesn't stop. So I open up again. The car stops. So I think to myself, is this the first person I killed? Or did I kill multiple people in the car? I don't know. And, you know, I just had a suspicion. We didn't know for sure. The car door opens up and the guy raises a white T-shirt from what I can see in the binoculars. And eventually the guy leaves the car and the car remains. And that was the only real, I guess you could say, head-to-head firefight that I could see the person I was shooting and, you know, clearly in the daytime. Most of the time it was at night. And in this particular location, we had a sandstorm. Now, you know, sandstorm, you know, classic. I mean, the East is a podcast. Let's talk about Orientalism and sandstorms and all this kind of stuff. Sandstorm, you know, the classic.
I'm cueing the Lawrence of Arabia theme
exactly,
right now.
Exactly. You know, finally the sandstorm comes, you know, the thing that everybody is expecting. So I'm telling you, it was very ominous because we knew that, number one, sandstorms are bad for weapons because weapons clog and they jam. Not necessarily AK. AK does well. M16, forget about it. That thing is very sensitive. So any sand and that thing clogs up and it's done for. So sandstorm comes in. And the thing about the sandstorm is that you don't have, you can't provide the coalition with locations and they can't see. So they can't bomb. There's no bombing missions during a sandstorm. They can't see. So they don't know who they're going to bomb. They don't know where they're going to bomb. And you don't
know.
How
can they drone during a sandstorm? They can't fly in a sandstorm.
They can't. Well, the thing is that even if they could fly above the sandstorm, they can't see through it. So right. The sandstorm provides the perfect cover for Daesh to attack us. And that's what they do. Now, we're up on the roof of this small village, only a handful of us. And the sandstorm rolls in and the wind's whipping around, sand's everywhere. And we're trying to cover, you know, I have a keffiyeh. And I have like a little slit trying to look through. And I'm just like, oh my God. And all of a sudden, they start shooting at us with anti-aircraft guns with explosive rounds. So over our head, we have ammunition exploding over our heads. We jump down. Now, basically what we've done on the rooftop is it's not just a rooftop now. We've taken oil drums and we've basically opened the lids and filled them up with sand. That's what we do all day is we fill sandbags and we fill pillowcases. And we fill oil drums with sand and dirt and put them on the roof so that we can create some sort of a protection for us, right? So we jump down behind those structures that we have on the roof and everybody starts screaming at each other. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? We're going to shoot back. We can't see. We don't know where they are. And I'll never forget that the other Heval in leadership said, we're not going to shoot back. We're going to keep quiet here and we're going to make them think that we're no longer here. So they shoot at us and they shoot at us and they shoot at us. And finally they stop. And we don't shoot back. And they didn't come and attack us. Because they had thought we'd left the village. And I thought to myself, God damn, sometimes it's better not to attack. It's not like, you know, war isn't like Rambo 2. Like where you're just always going to go in there. Brrr, ah, you know, everybody's just shooting everything up. No, we made the better decision not to shoot. Not to reveal our location. And we stayed alive. That's probably why I'm here. Had we revealed our location, for sure they would have sent suicide bombers on a mission to kill us, like they had done previously at one of our earlier...
And you couldn't have stopped them.
No, of course not. These people are in the middle of a sandstorm. They're going to come up the stairs. Even if they explode themselves on the stairs, you still could get shrapnel and you could die. So, of course, we didn't want to reveal ourselves. And we said, let them think that we're not here. And that was the best. And you know what? We survived. The following night, they attacked another point a few kilometers, and we could see it in the middle of the night, and they killed, I think, 7-8 SDF forces over there. And I thought to myself, that could have been us. That could have been us. At this point, mind you, at nighttime, when I'm on the patrol, you can see anti-aircraft tracer rounds going up in the air as the coalition is going over the city of Raqqa. But it wasn't until a few days later where the actual American bombardment of Raqqa began. And if I tell you, I remember it vividly because nobody could sleep. It was 24 hours of nonstop bombardment. And at that point, we knew that the U.S. Marines were behind us a few miles back, a couple of kilometers back with howitzers, basically, artillery. And the night that it started, all you could hear was boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, nonstop, all night. Aircraft, artillery. It was total war. Nonstop bombardment. And it was at this point that we realized that the Americans were also using white phosphorus. You could see it in the sky. It was like fireworks, but it was streaking down. And you could see the sparks going down in that classic like umbrella. And I thought to myself, fuck, I'm on the wrong side of the equation here. Like, I protested. I was always protesting against, the apartheid Israeli state use of white phosphorus in Gaza, for example, right? Because it's an illegal munition. And so we were always protesting, saying, Israel's committing war crimes and this and that. And here I am in a quote-unquote revolution allied with the coalition led by the Americans who are using white phosphorus against a city that has civilians in it still. And I thought to myself, this is a problem. This is a big problem. I couldn't take it anymore. I got really upset. I got frustrated. And there was a lot of comrades talking, disagreeing, fighting, denouncements, all this kind of stuff. And I began to get really disillusioned. After seeing, it was days and days of nonstop bombardment. Before we stepped foot into the city was under nonstop bombardment. And it was horrifying. It was horrifying. We're talking about total war. We're talking about World War II style.